Hi, welcome to Claim Edge, your resource for litigated claims management and resolution. I'm Jim Chapman, your host, and my guest today is David Van Alick, Senior Vice President with Richmond National Insurance Company, a specialty property and casualty insurance company focused on providing insurance to small and mid-sized businesses. Richmond National is a new carrier, writing coverage across the United States. David is the Chief Legal and Compliance Officer for the company. He shared his story of how he got into insurance claims and his professional journey from a trial attorney to senior executive with an insurance startup. I enjoyed the conversation, and I'm sure you will too. Because the Claim Edge podcast is focused on litigated claims, today we'll be talking with David about lawsuits that arise in the excess and surplus market and how technology is or could have an impact on litigation and claims management. David, welcome to the Claim Edge podcast. It's great to have you as a guest on our show.
Great. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, Jim.
So I know you're working for, in essence, a brand new insurance company, Richmond National. How are things going there?
It's growing great, Jim. Been here a little over a year now. We've been able to very effectively and quickly stand up a domestic surplus lines insurance company. And we're able to write business, you know, across the country at this particular point in time. It is amazing what one can do when you have a good, strong group of talented individuals from other E&S carriers that have joined us over the last, you know, 12 months. And at this point, we're, you know, north of 50 folks have launched all of our product lines, and things are going well. So certainly appreciate the opportunity to be on this podcast and share a little bit of our story, and share a little bit of knowledge in general about the industry.
Yeah, well, again, I really appreciate you joining us. It sounds like things are really progressing nicely there at Richmond National, so congratulations for that. One thing I do like to ask everybody that joins us as a guest is, how did you get into insurance? What was your journey into all things insurance?
That would harken back at this point roughly 15 years ago, you know, arguably even a little bit before that. But by my background, I'm an attorney, started in private practice out in San Francisco for an insurance defense firm out there at the time. It was relatively small, is now has offices in all 50 states. And so they're quite large at this point, a good group of attorneys over there, very talented. But that's probably where I first started learning about insurance, was while we were defending policyholders in the professional liability context, whether it was, you know, directors and officers or architects and engineers, other design professionals, other, you know, investment advisors, that sort of thing. There was always that insurance component that we needed to be cognizant of. And that's, as a young attorney, you quickly learn, okay, it's not just the policyholder that you, who is your client at the end of the day, by all means. I mean, you need to provide zealous representation to them. But the folks who are paying the bills are at an insurance, you know, carrier. And so need to be mindful with respect to maintaining proper budgets and bringing claims and cases, litigated cases, to resolution quickly. And that is a different mindset. It's not just about complaints been filed and what are the steps to prepare a responsive pleading. You know, what does the written discovery process look like? You know, what type of dispositive motions are you targeting? It's really well beyond that. It's how can this be resolved for the policyholder as quickly and cost effectively as possible? And so that's where I cut my teeth, was you know, working in that particular environment in San Francisco for several years. And when I made the move out to the Chicago area, I'm a Chicago native. Back in 2006, 2007, I was really looking to utilize those particular skills internally at a company. And being a former litigator, making the leap to an in-house role is a little bit more challenging. It's more your transactional attorneys, right? Your M&A attorneys that are typically fulfilling those types of roles. But one area that at the time was really recruiting heavily, you know, attorneys, and especially those with a litigation practice, were internal claim departments for professional liability carriers. or carriers who offered professional liability products. And so that was my first foray internally into the insurance industry. It was taking those strategic litigation skill sets into that particular environment and applying those skills broadly across a larger volume of litigated matters across the country, and really enjoying that part of it. It's one of those things where if your natural inclination is to try to resolve problems quickly and efficiently and cost effectively for your clients, I want to say that sometimes buttresses up against the financial model of a law firm. But a law firm billing by the hour, that doesn't necessarily resonate per se.
Sometimes there's a little disconnect, right?
Precisely. Sometimes. All the good firms, of course, they're going to try to do the right thing. But sometimes there's a little bit of a disconnect there. Within an internal claim organization, on the flip side, that is the paramount driver, is how can we provide the best service to our policyholders and the best defense, while at the same time trying to maintain controls over cost and expense and indemnity in order to keep premium levels at an appropriate level, at a reasonable level as much as possible, right? Because that inures to the benefit of the policyholders in the aggregate at the end of the day.
Yeah. So that was that's a great pathway in, and sort of an interesting segue to, what you've focused on for a good bit of your career, which is really the claims that end up in lawsuits, starting as a trial attorney and then trying to manage that in the professional liability space. Do you see much more of that in the, Richmond National's an E&S or excess and surplus lines carrier? Do you see much more of that in the role that you're in now, or at least in the E&S space?
Yeah, certainly in the E&S space, with respect to our particular company, and maybe for your listeners, I can break down if they're not familiar with E&S, the insurance products that our company sells are specialty products for commercial lines for businesses basically. So your general liability products. So if someone steps on your premises and has a slip and fall, there's coverage for bodily injury and property damage associated with that. Another major product we offer and others offer is commercial property. If something were to take place on your premises, maybe a named peril, that sort of thing, those would be covered. We also have excess casualty products. What that means is, your primary layer of general liability coverage, if you have $1 million in coverage with that policy, you may have a $5 million excess layer sitting on top of that. That's excess casualty. And it could go up from there. We also offer professional liability products. So whenever you meet with your accountant or your investment advisor or your attorneys or insurance agents and brokers, they too need errors and omissions insurance in the event that there's an inadvertent or negligent mishap in the handling of your particular situation as a policyholder. And, suit is brought against them in relation to that. Some of those are in allied health. We have allied health products as well for senior care facilities and that sort of thing. The difference between an admitted carrier and a surplus lines carrier is an admitted carrier will also offer comparable products, but they tend to do so for insureds that have been, around for a very long time, have good financial records, no claims history, typically. And so they're able to offer rates that are very favorable, but those rates tend to be set by various state departments of insurance, as well as the premium rates that can be charged to them are also somewhat restricted and directed by those states. The surplus lines market sits on top of that. So it's sometimes referred to as the hard to place risks. And again, these are good companies that maybe had a claim in the last 12 months, or maybe they're brand new startups, new businesses, such as ourselves, that have good track records with individuals from good companies. They too need insurance, but the admitted markets typically won't issue them a policy. So they need to go up to that surplus lines area. Given that that's, I'd say the market, I want to call it the market of last resort. That's not quite the right nomenclature for it, but given that layer of protection up there, because there's been prior claims history, sometimes you see more litigated claims. The volume of litigated claims tends to be a little bit more in that particular space. The policyholders themselves, again, because they've been involved in prior litigation or litigated claims, may have a relationship with a particular law firm that has defended them or worked with them historically. And so you tend to get more sophisticated insureds when it comes to litigated matters. And so then during the policy procurement process, you may receive requests for what are called choice of counsel endorsements, where a particular insured says, XYZ firm I've worked with maybe three times in the last 7 years. They're very familiar with my business. They're very familiar with the organizational structure. They're very familiar with the mission of our company and in our industry. And if we have a new claim coming in the door, we would like them to be there to defend us and represent us in court. And many a times, many carriers in this space will consider that as part of the procurement process, policy procurement process. And in fact, if there's a proper vetting, they'll endorse counsel on the policy itself. So that gives you a little bit of a flavor. It's you know, a little bit outside the box. It's more creative solutioning for insureds in the surplus line space, and that's what Richmond National focuses exclusively on.
So in the E&S space, it sounds like you would have your own what's referred to as panel counsel.
Right.
You've set up your own panel, your kind of list of go-to lawyers, jurisdiction by jurisdiction. And then in the case of at least some insureds, maybe many insureds, they have somebody that they prefer that isn't necessarily on that panel to begin with. Is that what I'm hearing?
That is exactly right. Right.
I guess if you get a chance to work with them and see what they're like, you might ultimately add them to your panel.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's happened countless times.
In that choice of counsel situation, do you actually vet them before the claim shows up?
Yes.
You know, understand what the rate structure is and those sorts of things so that you can add them in that endorsement?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. There was, it's important for any claim organization and underwriting organization to have that vetting process take place, typically by the claims side of the house, before the policy is even issued. And the reason being is, to your point, many E&S carriers, and as well as admitted carriers, but particularly E&S carriers, have a very deliberate approved panel counsel list has been developed over time, which continuously is updated, maintained as attorneys, you know, move on to other things. Some retire, you have rising stars in that particular profession. And so there's a constant shift and movement in terms of that particular panel counsel list. And also there are new areas of the law that evolve too. Cyber liability is a really good example of that breach response counsel. That didn't exist prior to 10, 15 years ago. And so, you know, folks develop that expertise, and you want to make sure that as a carrier, you've got the folks with the best expertise to represent your policyholders. And during the procurement process, as part of that vetting, you know, again, typically looking at identifying what their subject matter expertise is, asking other counsel in the area what their thoughts are of the attorney and the firm that's being proposed is very important. Also, locking in or identifying what the agreed upon rate structure will look like should a claim come in the door is also typically codified in the endorsement as well. I'll give you a little war story on that particular front. The reason why carriers and organizations do that is they don't want to necessarily run into a situation where a particular attorney or firm is being proffered to be choice of counsel, and it's potentially the a cousin of the, you know, the CEO of the insured who happens to do wills and estates work or something, you know. And they're not a litigator, but there was a very specific example I recall many years ago where I was asked to vet counsel, and I ended up finding and pulling up a Supreme, not U.S. Supreme Court, but a state Supreme Court order, which was charged with the responsibility of disciplining attorneys in that particular state. And it was bar order where that individual was suspended or had been suspended at least for a period of time for defrauding their clients and basically using their client trust funds for other purposes. And I recall I raised this with the underwriter, shared with them this particular order. They shared it with the wholesale broker and who shared it with the retailer and the insured. And they came back and they were just thanking me profusely, you know, for they said, you know, we would heard this person was good. So, you know, and it wasn't again that maybe they were terrible attorneys, right? But it certainly was another piece of or data point or piece of information that they had not been aware of, that they were happy that I made them cognizant of. And so we moved in a different direction at that particular point.
Well, yeah, I can certainly, you know, it's not just a question of maybe competence, but it's also, you know, this day and age, you got to think about your brand around that, right?
Precisely.
Who's actually defending you? Just kind of carrying that to the next level in the vetting process. Do you check their social media accounts? Are there concerns that might be raised in that regard that might disqualify somebody or at least require some investigation?
I think it's one of those things where it's another data point for consideration, right? Or at least something to bring to the policyholder's attention. But yes, I mean, in today's day and age, there are other avenues of information. I know historically, many folks would typically look at like the Martindale-Hubbell rating of counsel if they're part of you know, the trial lawyers associations or those other groups that where you're required to receive an invitation and you have to be a member of good standing. All of those things really do help and come out during the vetting process. And then, you know, to your point about do some of those folks then make it onto a full panel at some point? Well, you know, should a claim come in the door and they do a, you know, phenomenal job, it's actually we encourage it because we want to find those attorneys who are doing a great job and in getting the making those connections for the first time and establishing that relationship and ultimately strengthening it over time.
It sounds like a test drive opportunity.
That's exactly what it is. Yes.
So you mentioned, you know, lawyers, they retire, sometimes they change firms, that sort of thing. And of course, there's this, whether you call it the great resignation, I think of it more as the great in-house move. There are a lot of lawyers, corporations today are really sucking up legal talent. They're bringing people in-house because they want to reduce the cost to spend. They want to have more control over how the work is done and that sort of thing, which makes some sense. How has that impacted your ability to find in situations where you're losing somebody, find new counsel?
Yeah, it certainly is, you know, in the various, you know, partners, managing partners of firms that we work with and that I've worked with historically, I'll catch up with folks and just ask, you know, how are things going? And there certainly has been a challenge at firms at all levels, quite honestly, to maintain and recruit, you know, talent. And they're finding that they're losing talent to other law firms or folks are jumping into different practice groups or areas than they have historically. And so then from an internal position at a carrier, that's of course required a great deal of diligence and maintenance in terms of identifying who's where at this particular point in time, but also where the expertise, you know, lies and the depth of that expertise. And I think that's been a little bit more challenging. A lot of new faces, a lot of new folks are coming in. But with respect to some insureds who maybe had prior litigation experience with counsel, you're losing some of that connection of appointing someone who worked with them previously. And again, so then the ramp up time to for that per individual who very well could be very bright, talented, but it does take some time for that person to then to understand, you know, your policyholder, the industry that policyholder operates in, the players who are the key decision makers internally at that company, and all of those things that need to be quote unquote relearned take time. And again, you know, we alluded to it at the outset, time is money, right? So yeah. The expenses, I think, naturally tend to increase from just that dynamic alone, putting aside any what I call inflationary or wage inflationary effects you know, that are taking place with respect to firms and the compensation that they need to be paying their associates in order to not only maintain but recruit talent to their organizations.
One of the things that I've heard is that, particularly with newer attorneys, is they want more training opportunities. They want to really learn how to do a good job. And the rub often becomes with the carrier, they don't want to pay a junior lawyer to, they don't want to pay two lawyers to do one task or what is perceived to be one task. If, from your perspective on the carrier side, are there ways to either mitigate that or maybe it's just having the honest conversation about how best to address that so it ultimately meets the carrier's needs that there's new talent coming up through the pipeline, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And to your point, I think it's an honest and candid conversation that's typically taking place between the claim organization, the carrier, and the firm and the attorneys in particular, especially those that you've worked with for a long time. You trust their skill set. You trust their judgment. I will say that carriers aren't necessarily, I'd say, 100% reluctant to bring up that next level of talent and help build that particular pipeline, because they recognize at the end of the day that will ultimately inure to the benefit of the insured and the organization as a whole. It'll provide a better experience. I don't know if anyone's had a quote unquote great litigation experience, so I'll qualify it a little bit that way, but at least a less terrible experience through the litigation process if they have counsel who deeply understands them, their needs, their organization, their industry, and helping the firms build that next layer of talent, again, benefits the policyholder, which, you know, ultimately benefits the carriers too.
Well, I think to the point that you made earlier, there's this strong desire to make sure that the attorneys that are on your panel that are doing legal work to support the needs of your insureds are aligned with the interests of resolution. And not every claim can be, you know, resolved without a trial. But statistics would tell you that 96 or 97% of them can, and it's a question of which ones. It seems to me that there's potentially that additional, I'll call it training or alignment opportunity. If you can instill that at sort of the early part of the career of a, you know, defense attorney.
Exactly. And I'll give you two examples of that. So when I was a very junior attorney at the firm I was mentioning in San Francisco, one of the very first things I remember as a first year they presented me is we were had a complaint come in the door, and I was advised to go pull CalJIC, which were the California, you know, jury instructions. And I said, why are we looking at to how to instruct the jury? The suit is in it. In its infancy, it just started. Suit was just filed. We haven't even filed a response of pleading, a demur, or an answer, or anything. Come up with our affirmative defenses, and they said, no, pull out the causes of action that the plaintiff's counsel will need to prove from the jury instructions. And so you looked at the jury instructions and you looked at the various elements that needed to be established. And they said, okay, we're going to work backwards from there. What are the things that plaintiff is going to need to prove? And what are the things that are going to be the most challenging for them to prove? And what are the ways that we can tailor our discovery efforts to really provide the most vociferous and zealous defense possible to apply as much, you know, say, pressure to then resolve the case at the earliest, you know, moment, perhaps through a mediation. So again, the goal wasn't to take it to trial. It was to conduct an early mediation, but you needed to know what they needed to prove at the end of the day. And I thought that was absolutely brilliant. And so anytime we were working with counsel on various matters, I would share with them that particular practice that this firm had instilled in me. And then the second piece I wanted to share with you is some firms and some carriers will engage with their more junior attorneys a secondment program. And this is adopted a bit from secondments that are typically done in London. But long story short is in the US, many firms will place a more junior associate roughly 4 to 6 months with a carrier, maybe 2/3 of their time or maybe, you know, 80%, sometimes even 100%, where they will then sit with an internal claims organization and learn what I would call the risk tolerance of that particular group. And they tend to get a pretty good understanding of coverage issues that typically come up, you know, the ways in which to best, you know, resolve claims. And so they understand that the business of an insurance company and how best to meet the needs of the clients. And then they take those individuals, not only are they, you know, developing their own skill sets, but typically they're going back to their law firms and sharing that knowledge, you know, with the firm, so that the firm also has a better and deeper understanding as to how best to work with that particular insurance carrier and the lines of business that they tend to operate in. So it creates this synergy, so to speak, with that particular strategic partner law firm, as well as the carrier, while at the same time developing that pipeline of talent, which is so critical today.
Are you seeing a lot of carriers today that are actively engaged in that type of program?
I've definitely seen some. Yes. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. So it's. I don't know how common it is, but I certainly know it at my prior company, starting in about 2015. So several years ago, there was a what I call a reanimation of that particular program. It had been even like maybe a decade prior to that, where there was some element of that taking place. But certainly, with respect to litigated claims, I think it's an incredible, wonderful, eye-opening opportunity and development opportunity for a young attorney. I think it's a great opportunity for folks who were former attorneys who are inside claim organizations at this point to train and mentor individuals, and also kind of share the risk appetite, risk tolerance of the organization as a whole, and so they get a much deeper and better understanding as to what takes place. Again, when I was in private practice, I didn't have that particular opportunity with my clients. I was like, why does that insurance carrier want a status report? I'll get to it later. And of course, I was getting instructed quite well by my senior associates and partners of, Dave, you need to be on top of this. And of course, I was like, okay, you understand it, but until you're part of that organization, I don't think you have the true appreciation as to the pressures but more importantly the culture and the kind of the risk objectives and tolerances of an organization, and that's very difficult to understand from the outside looking in, and so this is an opportunity to deeply understand that.
Yeah, I've heard that the best litigated claim file is one that's closed.
Yes.
And how quickly can we get there, right?
Correct. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so when we started talking, this was offline a little bit earlier, you were telling me about how Richmond National is taking advantage of sort of the technological innovations that have occurred and become somewhat standard in today's insurance market. And right. I wanted to kind of springboard from that. Are there any that you're applying in the context of, I'll call it litigated claims management or the handling, whether it's reserving or, FNOL, kind of those sorts of things?
I would probably, posit at this point, we're still in the early stages of system development and that sort of thing. But I would say that from that perspective, we have the benefit of operating in a technology environment that isn't replete with legacy systems or multiple legacy systems and coding languages from 20 to 30 years ago. We have the benefit of being in the cloud and being able to operate very quickly and spin up servers, and so from that perspective, it is lightning fast. I would definitely say that in terms of process and automated process workflows, there certainly are opportunities in the specialty commercial lines space. They're not quite the same opportunities you see in personal lines, for example, like auto or homeowners or that sort of thing. Those to me are what allows maybe technologies to be leveraged a little bit more fully in those environments is that they tend to have much more homogeneous products, homogeneous insurance policies, And the claims themselves tend to be more homogenous as well. They tend to be, you know, a fender bender is a fender bender, right? When it comes to commercial lines and specialty lines, you're operating across some very different products. Professional liability is a claims made triggered product, which is, you know, markedly different than your general liability, which, you know, is triggered off of an occurrence. And so even the manner by which your insurance coverage is triggered differs. So it makes it a little bit more challenging for a claim organization to leverage some additional technologies. I do think when it comes to litigated claims and liability claims in particular, there are opportunities to leverage technology to really assist any claim organization. And it really can take place not just during the intake and ethnol period, but throughout the life cycle of a litigated claim. And in particular, I've been fascinated with some of the work done around by data scientists and others with respect to, you know, claim severity modeling. So what I mean by that, when say a lawsuit comes in the door, new loss, you could have some OCR technology basically scan through, read through the document, and flag particular key things and then score those indicators at a higher, you know, severity level. When those particular claims are being assigned, you can maybe have the higher severity ones routed toward your complex claims teams, you know, typically with former attorneys. And perhaps if there aren't those red flag indicators, it could go to more your, you know, high volume, low severity teams. And it's all about getting the claim in the hand of the proper examiner with the proper level of expertise at the proper time. And that's always the trick. And I do feel that there are technologies that can help provide that in the litigated claims context. So for example, again, if operative pleading comes in and in the upper left-hand corner of the pleading, it has the name of a particular, you know, law firm that the whole industry knows tends to take the largest and most severe types of cases, it could flag that, give it a fairly high score. And then that could be, you know, routed to, you know, the team that knows best how to handle those particular types of claims. Companies that aren't doing that, just as part of the normal intake and FBO process, they'll see, oh, it's a lawsuit. They don't know who the attorneys are. They don't know who the law firms are. And they'll just send it to somebody and then they'll auto-assign it to somebody who maybe doesn't have the expertise or knowledge as to how best to address it. And then perhaps they assign it to an outside counsel who maybe hasn't dealt with that attorney before. And you can see how the overall expenses and indemnity may escalate because of that routing that isn't quite to the best person in the organization. So I think that there are technologies in the litigated claim space that can really help facilitate or drive better results, again, for the policyholder at the end of the day.
Yeah, and take a lot of the friction out of the process at the same time. So that,
correct.
Because certainly humans could look at that complaint, and if somebody's got 20 or 30 years of experience and it includes having dealt with that specific law firm in the past, then right. You know, the light bulb goes off what the potential severity is. But
yeah, and on that particular point too, I think a really critical piece that folks should, you know, potentially ponder is not just at the intake point, you know, having that technology deployed, but what I call periodic sweeps through the file, right? Because any good claim organization will gather more information over time. The nature of a litigated claim file that doesn't resolve early or maybe gets past the, you know, summary judgment stage or other dispositive motion stage is getting ready for trial. And many a times you'll see a counsel, trial counsel, substitute in as co-counsel at the 11th hour. And it's, again, XYZ law firm that tries lots of these different cases and gets multi-million dollar verdicts, right? So if there's at least some technology to help flag these issues for folks, then they go, oh, okay, that firm's on it. There's still an opportunity then to do something about it, as opposed to just kind of putting up your hands and saying, oh, it is what it is. No, there's always an opportunity to provide a defense. And it wasn't unheard of when I was in my prior role at my prior company to also bring in co-counsel to help try cases who've perhaps tried cases against the other counsel who was brought in to try those cases. But you got to be, you have to have a process and a system, and technology can help with that to help flag those issues quickly so that you can act quickly, clear conflicts, and provide that best defense for your insured.
Yeah. Yeah. The pretrial report has already come in and you kind of know what the alignment is. And then whether it's 30 days or 15 days before trial, somebody else makes an appearance.
That's correct.
That hadn't been anticipated. Yes. I suppose technology could also help you identify who the best co-counsel to bring in on your team.
Correct.
To step in at the at that kind of last moment in time, or nearly last moment in time.
Oh, right. There's plenty of resources out there that help facilitate and identify who's litigated against who, what the ultimate results may have been, and that sort of thing. But if nothing else, at least you can get that comfort level knowing that there's a familiarity between counsel. I think with many carriers, recognizing with respect to your own counsel, your defense counsel, as a former litigator in a law firm, you always wanted to win, like regardless of what it took, right? And I think for many defense attorneys, especially when you're getting up on that trial stage, is recognizing from the carrier perspective that even if it turns out it's a plaintiff's verdict, but it's still significantly less than the last best and final demand that came over from the other side, that's still a win. That's still a win. So I think sometimes there's a little bit of a disconnect from defense counsel and the carrier's perspective on that as well.
You just need to have the right perspective, as you say, on it.
Right. Exactly. I remember it was, again, several years ago, I remember that was on a Friday. We had four pending matters that were out to verdict. And I think we got back one defense verdict, so zero, but I think the other three were all plaintiff's verdicts. But the amounts at issue that they ultimately, the verdicts came back were again, less than the last best and final from the plaintiff's attorneys and this was litigated suits across the country, trials across the country. And in the aggregate, I know that it was like seven figures were saved that day by taking it all the way through. So again, it's important to, have the wherewithal to go through that process and have a risk neutral approach to that process, as opposed to a risk averse approach, which you sometimes see out there quite a bit. But I think a thoughtful and deliberate risk neutral approach. And again, if you've been in, a trial attorney before, been in private practice before, you can, gauge that line maybe a little bit better. So.
Well, David, this has been a great conversation today. I really appreciate you joining us as a guest on the Claim Edge podcast. If anybody would like to get in touch with you afterwards, what's the best way for them to do that? How should they reach out to you?
They can shoot me a quick message through our website, richmondnational.com. Happy to connect with folks and answer any questions that I can. Yeah, it's, again, very exciting times for us and it being a new E&S carrier in the commercial line space, and looking forward to great things to come.
Well, awesome. And wish you great success. So thanks again for being a guest today.
Yeah, fantastic. No, thank you, Jim. Really appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.
It was a real pleasure to have David Van Alick from Richmond National as a guest on the Claim Edge podcast. I hope you enjoyed our conversation about lawsuits in the E&S insurance market, the impact of choice of counsel endorsements when lawyers change firms, and how technology can help claims professionals stay on top of their litigated claims. As David mentioned, if you want to connect with him, you can do that on the richmondnational.com website. Thanks for listening today. If you like this episode of Claim Edge, please subscribe on your favorite podcast channel and share it with your colleagues and friends. Until next time, this is Jim Chapman on the Claim Edge podcast, signing off.